I'm Layton Jay, and welcome to this module about quality and safeguarding in shared management. This is the final module in this series of resources, and I'd like to welcome Susie and Lou.
Hi, how are you going, Layton? Layton and I are your hosts today, and are looking forward to talking with you about quality and safeguarding. Layton, forgive me if you said this about every module in this course already, but this is a really important topic, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, Sue. And yes, it does seem like we've said that about all of the modules, but I guess that's a good thing, right?
Yes, I suppose it is.
Well, let's kick things off by briefly discussing some of the reasons why quality and safeguarding is so important. Perhaps, Sue, you can start us off by talking about what happens if providers don't pay enough attention to this in shared management and don't get it right.
Sure. There's probably two aspects to this. The first is the impact on people and families. And most obviously, failing to get quality and safeguarding right really increases the risk that a person may receive substandard services or experience neglect or abuse. At a personal level for that individual, that's likely to be traumatizing and humiliating. Mm. It's also an infringement of their basic human rights. So all providers must be vigilant and committed to ensuring that people who receive their services are safe from abuse and neglect.
So that sounds like the safeguarding element to me. Does the quality really get tied into that as well?
I think so. I think it does. If your services are substandard or poor quality, then that tells me that the risk of abuse and neglect is higher. Organisations that consistently deliver higher quality services have generally built systems and a culture that work together to reduce those risks.
Okay. Is there anything else that you'd add when you talk about the impact on people and families?
There's actually quite a long list I could go into. But the connections between these things and service quality won't necessarily be obvious to everyone at first glance. I know we'll be discussing them in more detail fairly soon. But to give you an example, poor quality services are likely to contribute to people living lives that are characterized by things like social isolation, loneliness, unemployment, and living on or, quite frankly, below the poverty line.
Yeah, we see that a bit, don't we? Now, you said there were two aspects to your answer, and the first one was the impact on people and families. I'm guessing the second impact is on providers themselves?
Yes. Not really rocket science, I guess, to figure that one out. Well, the most drastic impact of getting quality and safeguarding wrong, I guess, is losing your registration as a service provider.
Yep.
Obviously, that only happens in extreme situations, but there are a bunch of regulatory responses that can happen for lesser sins, if you want to call it that, that will still make life uncomfortable for you and divert a lot of energy and resources to fixing things that really should have never been broken in the first place.
Yeah, yeah.
And another impact is that your best staff are likely to leave. And lastly, there's also damage to your reputation. We live in a very small world.
Yeah, and a connected world, isn't it? Well, that's a snapshot of some of the things that can happen if providers don't get quality and safeguarding right. Is this quality and safeguarding stuff all preventative, or are there benefits that result when organisations do get it right?
Oh, of course there are benefits, definitely. These are mostly the flip side, I guess, of the things we've just spoken about. People and families feel safe, and they can certainly feel confident that they aren't at risk of neglect and abuse. And they're confident that their provider is genuinely interested in seeing them receive high-quality support and thriving.
Okay.
I think that's the key. And they'll be getting on with living the life they want to have. They'll be connected to other people, belong to their communities, they'll have friends, they'll have a safe place to live, and hopefully a way out of the poverty trap.
Okay. So there are a lot of benefits for people. Are there benefits for providers?
Layton, I know you've talked a fair bit about culture throughout this course, but once again, this is a really important thing here. And remember that a useful shorthand definition of culture is the way things are done around here because of what we believe in.
Yeah, and the beliefs, yeah. And sometimes I find it can be really helpful to spell out the way things are done around here to mean, look, it's really about the behaviours, the actions, the decisions, the way people interact with one another, very observable things.
Absolutely. And if you're a provider that has really good services and frontline workers who are committed to delivering those services in a way that aligns with great values then that becomes a self-reinforcing cycle that builds and maintains your culture.
Yeah, yep.
And because you have a great culture, you'll deliver high-quality services. And then that in turn contributes to maintaining a great culture.
So you've got that cycle thing going.
So as a provider, ideally, you'll want to monitor what your real service quality is like and not be scared to know what really is happening in people's homes and out in the community. I guarantee that this will give you some really useful direct input about how your culture is tracking.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think that's really helpful, Sue. It's also a great intro into the first activity, which is activity 7.0 in your workbook if you're watching this video or listening to the podcast. So we just want you to turn to that now in your workbook. This will enable you to loosely assess how your organisation is currently tracking with respect to quality and safeguarding. Now, you'll see there are six statements there. We simply want you to rate your organisation against each of those statements. If you completed module one, then this will look familiar. You will have done this as part of the last activity in that module. So if you want to look up your answers from module one and transfer them to here, feel free to do that. But just pause the recording now, do this activity. When you're ready to go on, click play. This gets us straight to the learning outcomes for this module. Now, there are five of these, and you can find them in the introduction to the Module 7 workbook. Let's quickly run through them, Sue.
Okay. One is identify the factors that contribute to you and others being safe and feeling safe.
Two, describe how these factors are relevant to high-quality contemporary disability services.
Three, discuss how these factors can be applied in shared management arrangements.
Four, explain to people and families why quality and safeguarding is important.
And five, describe how your organisation can effectively, and we hope unobtrusively, monitor quality and safeguarding in shared management arrangements.
Let's get straight into addressing the first learning outcome by turning to Activity 7.1. In the disability sector, discussions about quality and safeguards can easily get focused on some highly technical things related to what the system requires of people and families and providers. And while we do need to look at these elements, we think it's more valuable to begin the discussion by reflecting on what contributes to you personally being safe and feeling safe.
Absolutely, I agree. And this is a really valuable starting point.
So we want you to pause the recording now and make some notes in the space provided in your workbook. It should only take you 2 or 3 minutes. If you can discuss your answers with a partner before continuing, that could be helpful. And again, click play when you're ready to go on. How did you go? Sue and I are going to discuss our thoughts in response to this question now. And as you listen in or watch, you might want to add to your notes. Sue, what is it that contributes to you being safe and feeling safe?
There are probably quite a few things, Leighton. But for me, it's primarily my friendships and relationships. And I also think that's the case for most people.
Mm.
There are things like security screens on my house, airbags in my car, the laws that we have that make sure we all drive on the right side of the road or the left-hand side of the road here, and government policies, for example, they all have their place and they all obviously contribute to my safety.
Yeah.
But I think ultimately having people around me, around us who know us well, who love us and look out for us, is when we feel safer and actually are safer. So for me, most of those people are friends with whom I have reciprocal relationships, you know, the love, sharing and caring that goes both directions. Mm-hmm. If I get unwell or I'm facing a dilemma, having an issue in my life, they're the people who are going to support me, and vice versa, I'll support them at those times.
Okay. Yeah, that's also my number one response. And I think about my personal network, it includes a whole variety of people like family members, close friends, some less close friends, some acquaintances and some work and professional colleagues. There's also probably a few people that I have a paid relationship with, like my local barista. She is someone I see on a fairly regular basis, and she knows me and she knows the other regulars.
We need our barista.
Yeah, but at the end of the day, it's mostly the people I'm closest to who are the main ones who've helped keep me safe.
Yeah, I also think that having a sense of control over my life helps me to feel safe too. For example, with a few restrictions here and there, I have a high degree of choice about where I live and who I live with, mm-hmm. who comes into my home. That all helps me to feel safe. Now, I know we could probably go into a highly philosophical discussion about the difference between feeling as if I'm in control versus actually being in control of it, but I don't think you or I want to go there
right
now.
No, that's probably right.
But it's enough to say that no matter what safeguards we put in place, random and things we can't predict, these things happen that people have no control over, and it can happen every single day.
Yep.
Whilst we can't prevent all those things from happening, we can still feel pretty safe, and that seems to be very important for our overall health and well-being, including our mental health.
Yeah, and sometimes we can put a bit of a plan in place for when some of those things might happen, or if they happen, then we've got some way of being a bit prepared and a bit better able to respond. Mm-hmm. Now, when you speak to people about what helps them to feel safe, it's pretty clear that it means different things to different people. Knowing that people care about them is right up there. But they also tell us things like, no one is going to hurt me. When I know what the rules are, I feel safer. Having a say in the way that things happen to me, I feel safer. Having people listen to them, knowing that people will help them if they have a problem. Now, I reckon that's a pretty good list that I think would be probably true for most of us. Mm. A colleague of mine, Dr. Sally Robinson from Sutherland Cross University, has also researched this topic with people with intellectual disability. And they say a lot of very similar things. A couple of the other points that they make include being able to manage their feelings, mm. being in places that they know and are familiar with, and feeling an absence of threat or harm. But having a sense of control over what happens to them and having people that listen to them and that they can trust in their lives, those were right up there as important factors.
Absolutely. And it's also worth noting that the NDIS Act, the National Disability Insurance Scheme Act, gives people with disability the same right to be safe and feel safe as everybody else.
Yeah, that's right, Sue. And if you want to look it up, that right is explicitly upheld by Section 4 of the Act, and you could look at Clauses 6, 7 and 10 to see what they say.
So this is really important, Leighton, and for me it's one of the places where safeguards and quality interact. But I also think that many organisations don't see the connection or choose to ignore it for whatever reasons. We tend to think of service quality in terms of the way workers treat people, the equipment and facilities that are provided, and things that the national standards, for example, point providers to pay attention to. And those are certainly things that are part of the quality equation. But a big thing that seems to go missing way too often is the piece about people having friends
yep.
or relationships
yes.
who, with people who may not have a disability that they can have a freely given kind of reciprocal relationship with. This is a significant contributor to keeping you and me and anyone else safe. It becomes fairly apparent that people who don't have friends around them are much more vulnerable to exploitation, to abuse, to neglect, and they generally can find themselves in situations where they just don't feel safe.
And that's the case for people without disability too, isn't it?
Absolutely.
What I think you're saying here, Sue, is that some providers, and maybe it's lots of providers, may seem to offer quality services when you look at things like their customer satisfaction scores, but in fact the quality of their services is compromised because they might not actually be focusing on the right things. For example, if they don't train their frontline workers in how to help a person build or maintain a network of friends, when the reality for that person is that they need lots of assistance and support to be able to do that, maybe they're not doing the right thing. Without a network around the person, like the one you described yourself, that person's safety is really a bit compromised and they're at the discretion of people who have paid roles in their life.
That's right. I think there's a major implication here for how providers support anyone that comes from thinking about quality and safeguards in this way. And that implication is that frontline staff need to be able to support people to live the sort of lives that the person of that age and culture whose peers who don't have a disability live their lives. Having a robust network of friends and acquaintances is a key element of what makes up a good life for pretty much anyone of any age and any background.
Yeah, I completely agree with you on that, Sue. And that leads me to ask providers questions like, do your support worker position descriptions expect or require workers to support people to make new friends or maintain existing relationships? If not, why not? Do you recruit support workers who have skills and experience to do this? Do you provide training to them to enable them to do it? Do your performance conversations ever examine how well workers are doing this? Now, slightly different topic, does your organisation adopt SRV principles and approaches to underpin all of your services? And if you don't know what SRV is, the answer to that last question is almost certainly no.
Absolutely.
You probably want to bring this discussion to a close. So I'll just summarise by saying that for many providers, quality and safeguarding get seriously compromised because organisations focus on the wrong things when they design and deliver their services.
Rather than bring the discussion to a close, Sue, I'm going to use what you just said as a segue into the next activity, 7.2. So please turn to it now. In this activity, we're inviting you to explore how the friendships factor that we've just been talking about is relevant to safeguarding and quality in contemporary disability services. The discussion we've just been having should have given you some initial thoughts, but we want you to pause the recording and take a few moments to reflect and write some notes in the spaces provided in your workbook. Click play when you're ready to resume.
There's a growing body of evidence and resources around approaches like the Circles movement and SRV, social role valorization, and it is really clear that they work incredibly well for lots of people who get good support to put these into action. It's also really worth noting that these approaches align very strongly with values of true social inclusion, mm-hmm. belonging, and empowerment. Most providers could be doing a lot more to adopt these sorts of approaches themselves and to embed them into their services.
Yep. And I think if I was a provider and it seemed hard to know how to start, just begin with John or Mary or Amir and just one person and ask, what will it take to adopt this sort of approach to support this one person in their life? And just asking that question will lead to different answers and open new possibilities and pathways and new discussions. So we're trying to break this down and illustrate the beginning to shift things in your organisation. It can start with small steps and trials. It doesn't necessarily mean you have to redesign your whole organisation, or certainly not right at the start of moving in this direction.
Absolutely agree. And I guess just to summarise, you know, for many providers, true quality and safeguarding gets seriously compromised because organisations don't focus on this. They don't focus on supporting people to build and maintain friendships with people who don't have a paid role in their life. I know we've said this, but it's worth just saying it again.
Yeah. Well, that's great. So now, given that this course focuses on shared management, it leads to an obvious next question. How does the focus on friendship building and maintenance apply to shared management arrangements? And that's activity 7.3, which we'll look at in your workbook now. For this one, we want you to pause the recording for a few minutes and spend a few minutes reflecting on the question.
Remember that a key characteristic of shared management is that the person or family member is in the lead and has more choice and control. And in that context, it's really interesting to ponder how focusing on this friendship building and maintenance applies within the context of shared management.
Okay, so click pause now, make a few notes and discuss your thoughts with a partner if you can. And when you're ready to continue, you know what to do, click play. How did you go with that? Once again, Sue and I are going to have a brief discussion about this question, and we invite you to add to your workbook notes as you follow along. Sue, it's actually a fairly obvious question that I want to ask you about this one, and it relates to something that you said a few moments ago. If the person or the family member is by definition the leader of their shared management arrangement, how or why would a provider have a role in pushing a line like, you have to have more friends?
Okay, I don't think it's really about pushing a line, I guess. I think that the reality is that lots of people who are interested in shared management are interested in it precisely because they want different outcomes and approaches to what they see that they can get in more traditional services.
Yep.
So in that respect, lots of people who choose to share manage will expect, want, or at least be very open to being supported to build and maintain relationships, to build and maintain friendships.
Okay, yeah, that would fit with my experience too. So should this now be part of the initial shared management or service agreement discussion that providers have with people?
Well, it makes sense. It makes sense that it should at least be explored during that conversation. And I think that putting it in the context of enhancing the person's safety and the quality of their life is a very positive way of bringing it up as a topic of conversation.
Indeed. And in my experience of these situations, it's often mum and or dad who are the person's share management representatives, and they see risks rather than opportunities when they try to envisage their family member outside of a disability-specific environment or program. That's not for everyone, for sure, but that's certainly sometimes the case. And sometimes the person themselves, in my experience, also voices strong reservations about leaving disability-specific environments or trying something new and different. So if people with these beliefs are the share management leaders, don't providers just have to respect their choices to stay in these more isolated settings and programs?
Yes and no. I guess keeping in mind the perspective of the mums and dads and people may well be a real consequence of the experience that they've had to date.
Yes. Right?
And absolutely, if they have that perspective, listening to them and respecting their choices should be a core value. But by the same token, I think, you know, life is a journey for all of us, and our beliefs and ideas evolve, they develop, and they change over time on all sorts of things, including by what you have and haven't been exposed to. So it's worth talking to people to try and see whether they can be exposed to something new and something different, regardless of what their past experience may or may not have been.
Yep.
I mean, your dad, how have your thoughts about inclusion evolved over time?
Well, that's a good question, Sue. My son is 31 now, but he went right through school in segregated schooling. And my wife and I, if we have any regrets now, that would be, one of them would be that we didn't at least explore what might have been possible in terms of him and inclusive schooling. As he approached the end of school, so that's going back quite a few years now, at the time, I truly believed that the only options open to him were the traditional options like disability day programs and group home living. My beliefs about what's possible, what's best for him, have changed massively in the last 10 years or so, mostly because I've been exposed to lots of examples of what works well for other people. Now, his provider, in our case, has had a big role to play in helping me to learn about this, and it's probably also important to add that another mind shift for me has been the shift to respecting that as an adult, the decisions about how he lives his life are his decisions to make, not mine or my wife's. Now, I'm not naive enough to think that we always get that right, but I sure as heck know that my other two children, who are in their 20s, they're not going to let me make decisions for them. It's simply not normal or healthy, if you like, for parents to be deciding big and small decisions for their children who are adult children and need to be finding their own way in life. And that pertains for our kids with disability too.
Yeah. So, you know, in terms of you talking about respecting decisions, how have you gone with supporting your son to then make these decisions?
Well, it's been a journey and still is. We're definitely getting better at it. And by we, I mean my wife and I and his paid workers and the friends that surround him. And we all have this as a pretty ongoing focus. I mean, we know, for example, the more we can make things really concrete for him rather than abstract, the easier it is for him to express an opinion or preference. For example, with his recruitment, he makes decisions about who will work with him. The rest of us set up and run a whole process around that that makes it easy for him to do that in a concrete way. When we wanted years ago to explore whether he wanted to travel, I actually took him on a plane flight to Kalgoorlie to find out what he thought. So it was really concrete.
Yeah, a great idea. I do wonder whether we're kind of getting slightly off topic here.
Well, a little bit off topic, Sue, but it reinforces some of what we talked about in Module 5, that providers have a role in supporting people and families who are doing the innovative and effective things to share their knowledge, their skills and their experience with other people and families.
True.
And I know from my own personal experience, seeing and experiencing what other people and families are actually doing, and that's not just hearing about it, it's meeting the people, it's going to their homes, it's been incredibly helpful for me. And it opens up a whole new set of dreaming and possibilities, and it's inspired me and us and motivated us to give new things a go.
So really what I'm thinking, though, is that providers don't need to have all the answers here.
No,
I don't
no.
think they need to jump to that thought. And they certainly don't necessarily have to try to convince people and families that they have to build friendships with people who don't have a disability if they aren't ready for that.
No, not at all. And someone described our role in supporting our son to build friendships was, as parents, we can't make those friendships for him. Again, that comes back to it's not a normal role for parents. What we can do is cultivate a garden that people want to come into. And providers can do the same thing, I think. They can cultivate a garden that can bring people and families together to share their ideas. And they can point people to resources that will help them. That's the kind of thing I think providers can be doing.
Mm. And I guess it's worth saying, when you're talking about sharing ideas and resources, WACE has some stories on our website of people who are really achieving some very good outcomes. And we know of lots of other organisations and groups that also have fabulous stories on their websites too.
Yeah, we've provided some links to some of these in the supplementary resources for this module. When it comes to specifically building friendships, there's a fairly new national resource that's dedicated to providing up-to-date information and resources about circles of support and microboards. Right. We've provided a link to this and a bunch of other helpful resources in the supplementary materials too. Now, if you're following along with us and you're thinking, this is not what I expected for this topic, I can pretty much guarantee you won't be the only one thinking that. We are going pretty hard on this angle about friendships because it's such a fundamental starting point to our experience of being safe and having a good quality of life that most of us don't even think about it.
Absolutely. And it's worth mentioning the NDIS's quality and safeguard framework is built around what they call three basic domains: developmental, preventative, and corrective. And just using the Commission's words, developmental measures help to strengthen the capability of people with disability, disability workers, and suppliers of supports under the NDIS. The preventative and corrective measures help to ensure appropriate responses to issues that arise, as well as identifying opportunities to prevent them in future, either through a regulatory response or through education and capacity building.
So with that kind of description, surely relationship building should be front and centre in the developmental or preventative domains, or both.
Mm.
And so we're banging on about this because it is so important and also so often overlooked or omitted from far too many discussions that it should be central to or at least a part of. And as the NDIS Quality and Safeguarding Commission continues to roll out, we really hope we'll see more and more about this.
Yeah, I agree. Now, before we move to the next activity, I just wanted to briefly summarise this discussion for people who are kind of adding the notes to their workbooks.
Oh, that's a good idea.
So I think you stressed the point about how important real, unpaid, reciprocal relationships are, friendships are, for everyone's safety and quality of life. So I think maybe enough said about that one for now, because we've kind of said it quite a bit.
Yep.
Secondly, though, it's probably more prudent and more effective for providers to be exploring how they can connect people and families to other people and families who are doing good things and getting great outcomes already. You don't have to have all the answers yourself.
Yep, I think it's a good point.
And thirdly, begin the discussion about the role of relationships, of friends, in safeguarding and enhancing life quality when you have your initial shared management service agreement discussion. And fourthly, check in with Module 5 about what providers can do to support people and families being leaders for other people and families.
That's a great summary, Sue. Now, bringing some order out of our somewhat random conversation, shall we go on to Activity 7.4?
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at Activity 7.4 in your workbook, you'll see that our intention here is to help you get really clear about why providers need to ensure that their share managing people and facilities engage with them around quality and safeguards. You'll see that we've given you a space to make some notes in response to this question. We want you to pause the recording now and take a few moments to answer the question, why is it important for people and families to know about quality and safeguarding? Again, if you've got a partner that you're doing this module with, talk about your answers with them before you click play and continue with the recording. How did you go? In a few minutes, I'm going to share some thoughts about this from a family member's point of view, and I know, Sue, that you're going to have some valuable insights on this from all your work with people, families and providers.
Such faith.
But first, let's just check in and see what some providers have to say about this for themselves.
I think that there's a great need for education, and I think the education needs to go beyond service providers. There needs to be education that families can attend, that support workers can attend. I think there needs to be a lot more of that type of thing and resources so that people have a greater understanding of the potential risks and the hazards in employing staff and what they need to look out for and the things that are okay for a worker to be engaging in and the things that are questionable. And it's always a difficult and sometimes a blurred line when you're working in somebody's home.
Getting them to understand the why behind that, and usually people do agree because it's about their safety as well as ours, so it's about everyone feeling safe and secure together down that path. Yeah.
Yeah, I think once you explain the rationale, usually people will go, yeah, that does make sense. If someone's really resistant, you try and explore why they are. And if they're saying, well, I'm not going to do any of those things, then you have to question, is shared management the right option? And, you know, maybe they need a bit more support in the beginning and maybe you need to be a bit more involved. It's not necessarily a no. It might have to be if it gets to that point. And I suppose that's the provider being clear on what they're willing to take on and not take on. But, yeah, the partnership, if you revisit that, you're saying, look, we're going into this together, so we both need to do our part to make it work, I suppose.
There's six basic disability services standards and getting them to think about what they can do, what support people can do, their employees, what they can do to support those things and what the provider can do. So working through some of that stuff is really useful.
So what strikes you out of that and what do you want to add to what Ema, Mel and Carol had to say?
Well, based on my experience, I want people and families to be really clear that there are actually legal and regulatory requirements around quality and safeguarding, and they can't simply ignore these.
Yeah.
But nor do they have to be, nor do I want them to be, overwhelmed or weighed down by them. Mel, Ema and Carol talked about how important it is to address this right up front. And I thought some of their suggestions about how to do that were really positive and quite practical. Mel's suggestion of using the national standards as a starting point and basis for talking about why quality and safeguarding is important and what the key elements are is a really useful idea, I think.
Yeah, I like that one too. And, of course, the Quality and Safeguards Commission is taking over. And as that happens, it might make sense to use some of their documentation resources as that happens in your area. But the key is really to keep it simple, isn't it?
I think so. Yes, I agree. It's really easy to get lost in the language and detail with these things, and that's not what most people or families want.
No.
I also thought that Ema made a great point when she emphasised that shared management is a partnership and that you have to maintain a partnership approach with the person and family when there are quality and safeguarding issues that might include things not quite going as they should be.
Yeah.
And what I really like about what they had to say is that they're demonstrating how shared management works in practice as a capacity-building approach. And capacity-building is a core principle that underpins good shared management. So I think it's really worth noticing how they put this principle into action.
That's a great pickup, Sue.
Look, I think it's also worth stressing that providers can really only fulfill their quality and safeguarding obligations if they have the cooperation of the person and family. And the best option by far is, in my opinion, what Mel explained. Try to get the person and family on board and working with you to make sure that the legal requirements are well understood right from the start. And this includes a common understanding about who's responsible for what and how you'll both monitor these things.
Now, so quality and safeguarding covers serious incident reporting and restrictive practices and positive behaviour support too, doesn't it? Do you want to say anything about those things?
Yeah, it does. And that illustrates how nuanced this aspect of service provision has become and how important it is that people and families know about it and engage with it.
Yeah.
None of these things need to be problematic for people, families or providers though. But if people don't understand what's required in relation to each of these, and more importantly, why these things are requirements, then I think they'll be unaware of some of the tools and resources that could potentially be very useful to them.
Mm.
This isn't just about ensuring that people and families meet compliance obligations, you see. As Mel said, it's a great way to open up conversations with people and families about what good quality services are more generally.
Okay. Now, Sue, we haven't discussed any of the changes that are coming with the NDIS Quality and Safeguards Commission. We've mentioned it. Do you want to say anything about that?
Well, like the NDIS itself, this is a whole new ballgame, isn't it, really, in a way? Mm. You mentioned, or actually I mentioned, the three domains of the quality and safeguarding framework a little while ago. And I think it's actually very helpful for providers, as well as people and families, to think about what they're doing in each domain to improve quality and safeguarding.
So that's the developmental, preventative and corrective.
Yeah. And what are they doing with respect to individuals, families, support workers and for providers organisationally? But honestly, like the NDIS, this is all evolving.
Yeah.
The Commission is putting out new resources on a fairly regular basis, so it's definitely important that providers stay informed about what's going on with them. There are also some really useful training resources that specifically focus on this, and we've referenced some of this in the supplementary materials.
Great. I always seem to get to this point in the modules and feel like, wow, it's been a lot in this, and it does get us now to activity 7.5. This is our last activity, so if you're listening and following us still, hang in there with us. We've got a little bit to go, but we're nearly there. This activity focuses on how providers can effectively monitor quality and safeguards in shared management. And that's with the aim, as we said at the start, of not being intrusive in people's lives. If you've found the right page in your workbook for activity 7.5, it'll look like this.
There's a space for you there to make notes in your workbook as you hear from our shared management practitioners again. We ask them to tell us what they do and what they find to be most effective when monitoring quality and safeguards.
And they had some good suggestions. Here they are.
The best thing that we do ongoing is just to keep up the home visits on a regular basis where we can, because I think for a lot of people it's just not understanding. It just feels like a big deal, something that you've got to do for really no reason. But when you start to give people a greater understanding of why, I think they're a bit more reasonable about it and see it as a greater priority.
Having the time for the face-to-face,
yes,
and regular catch-ups.
Yep.
And a lot of people, I note in rural areas, are often very self-sufficient. They're often come from, you know, hard, tough backgrounds where working class people and we're okay and, you know, we've done this for a long time and we've got it worked out. And so there's often, I think, a lot of barriers to break down when you're meeting with people, is that, you know, genuineness and authenticity and a real care and concern for the people that we're dealing with is paramount.
In terms of safeguarding from an organisation perspective, it's really about that relationship. So the advisor or coordinator getting to know the person well, going to the house, going to where the person lives, going to the workplace, maybe meeting a few of the staff, not from a supervision perspective, but you get a feel for how the supports work when you go there, and there's, you know, a casual feel. And the provider needs to have that line between giving the support and being in partnership, but also meeting their quality and safeguarding outcomes. And
I think the budget monitoring is also really, really important.
Yep.
Because overspending and underspending are both significant alerts for a provider. You know, if someone's underspending, it may well be they're having some trouble recruiting the right people, so you might want to check in with them and see if they need some help with that. And also overspending, obviously there's you know, something that's going on that may need, they might need a little bit more support. Or so it's about talking through the guidelines around restrictive practice and how that all works, and also looking at how can we help to try and problem solve that. And very much around supporting people to pull in the necessary supports to help them problem solve. The provider may not necessarily have the expertise, so it's brainstorming who does, and being able to invite people to the table.
So how did you go? So let's summarise their main points.
Okay. The first thing that stood out for me was the importance of addressing the potentially tricky elements of quality safeguarding and monitoring during the initial discussions when establishing the service agreement.
Mm-hmm.
They all mentioned this, and being really clear at that point about who is doing what.
Yeah, I noticed that one too. It's almost like a preventative step in terms of reducing the risk that monitoring the arrangement will itself become a problem in the future.
Yeah, and related to that, they all also emphasise the importance of the relationship they as providers have with people and families. Carol spoke about how important it is that people and families perceive your genuineness, authenticity, and genuine caringness, and that hopefully that perception reflects reality.
Yeah. Another point they made was the importance of meeting people in their own homes, if at all possible. And Carol said she really tries to do that with her initial meetings. Though off camera, when she was talking to me, she also spoke about how challenging that is as a regional provider. For her, there's a real challenge related to the distances involved, just physically getting to everyone's house. And lots of people in regional areas have a strong independent streak, so some of them have been reluctant to have home visits.
Mm. And Mel and Emma both discussed monitoring budget and acquittals as being a really insightful behind-the-scenes monitoring activity. Things like, you know, deviations from the plan, goals or budget can be useful indicators that a personal check-in might be a useful next step.
Yeah, I really like that one. I think it's a great way to do some very low-key monitoring in terms of, you know, intrusiveness. What else caught your attention?
A couple of things. When it comes to recruiting workers, people are generally very clear about what they're looking for and are more willing to prioritise the workers' fit and then train them in specific skills they might need. Mel mentioned that helping people know what their employees can do themselves to improve and monitor quality and safeguarding can be a really useful strategy for people.
Yep.
And Ema, she emphasised the importance of people being clear about why these things are legal requirements. She specifically spoke about working with people around things like serious incident reporting and restrictive practices, like you mentioned before. And the sense of partnership needs to be preserved in these situations too.
Thanks, Sue. I'm really conscious that we've covered a lot of material in this module, again, like we have with most of them, and yet there's still a lot of detail areas in this that some providers might want to know more about. Now, we've tried to address this by creating quite a few supplementary resources or pointing people to other resources, so be sure to check them out if you do want more detail on specific issues. So I want to say a huge thank you to you again for co-hosting this module with me. I think it's really great that we get to tap into your knowledge and wisdom.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure, Leighton. And to everyone who's been on the journey with us through this course, thank you. And all the best as you continue on your path to hopefully developing, refining, and delivering high-quality shared management with people and families.
Hear, hear. So I want to say to everyone who's done the modules, thanks for staying with us. And I really want to say to all the people that have been part of producing the modules and have shared their experience and their knowledge and skills and wisdom, co-hosted with me, a huge thank you for doing that. So all the best. Don't forget to check out the supplementary resources. Au revoir.
See you.